Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I hold an immense amount of guilt for the narrative that I played out, you know, online.
Alice Living was offered her first six-figure book deal at age 22, whilst known online as Clean Eating Alice. What I really wanted from this episode was for it to be a really open and frank conversation about the reality of different trends on social media, but also can have an impact on the people perpetuating the trend.
I was on the front cover of Women's Health magazine. I had this rippling six-pack.
At what point did you realise that your content needed to change?
When an article came up in the Daily Mail that said Alice is the cause of eating disorders, and I remember having a complete physical breakdown.
The fact that we make teenagers so famous and put them in such a position of authority creates an environment that it makes that happen.
I go on TikTok now, Grace, and I'm terrified by what I see. Guys, you're doing what I did. Stop.
In an industry that encourages exploitation, if a 19-year-old blows up tomorrow, as soon as that person gets some negative press, no one's going to stop for a second at dropping that and moving on to the next.
I now am terrified of being online. There are going to be pockets of the internet that continue to perpetuate these toxic narratives.
With social media now, like, it's probably far more pervasive, and I'm not sure how we do stop that.
I'll tell you my kind of like rock bottom moment.
What is up, and welcome to Working Hard, Hardly Working. Today's episode features the super inspiring Alice Living. Alice is the definition of a multi-hyphenate, a personal trainer, best-selling author, founder, influencer. She was offered her first six-figure book deal at age 22, whilst known online as Clean Eating Alice. But since then, Alice's career has taken a turn, pivoting away from clean eating and towards balance, sustainable exercise, and well-being. What I really wanted from this episode was for it to be a kind of really open and frank conversation about the reality of social media and the reality of different trends on social media and how they can have an impact on all of us, but also even on the people perpetuating the trend. I didn't expect this conversation to be so honest and open, to be honest. I thought it was really, really incredible how she was able to share that with us. And I do think it's a kind of lesson on growth and why we don't need to be too harsh on ourselves about our past decisions. I've never heard a conversation like this happen, especially around things like social media and diet culture and the realities of kind of what social media used to be, what social media can be now, and the issues with perpetuating trends within social media for kind of everyone. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you do, please don't forget to like and subscribe and review wherever you're listening. It really helps the podcast and helps us to get some nasty the office like this, but also all of the incredible guests we're going to have this year. And I cannot tell you how excited I am. We have so much in store.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to chat. I feel like we have a lot to talk about, especially as people who kind of started a career within the fitness industry. When you're shot into a position that you're in, you kind of need to be in that position. You need to do the thing. You've had a really, really interesting journey in terms of what you originally kind of came into fame for, and then kind of talking about your journey since then and everything. I just think it's incredibly interesting. So I very much want to get into that. But first of all, I would love to speak a little bit about your kind of early career. As a young person, that sounds like you're not young now. She looks at me with a youthful glow. But when you were kind of a teenager, did you always want to kind of work in fitness? Were you always interested in fitness?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Also, just I want to say how nice it is to like have seen your growth as well. You know, when you referenced them, we started at the same time. So it's amazing seeing you do so well. And I genuinely say that, like, I'm so happy for you. And I love that I'm sat here in this position. It's so nice. In answer to your question, did I always want to work in fitness? No. Growing up, I was never sporty. When I think back to my kind of sporting journey, I was the kid at school who would do anything to get out of every games lesson, every opportunity that I had to move my body, I was like running the other way.
Mm.
You know, I think that tied up in that, as I started to recognize that exercise was something that I kind of had to do as part of my school experience, I then pivoted to be like, right, well, I guess I'll just do it from a fat loss perspective, you know?
Right.
I was one of those kids who grew up at the time when you'd spend your, you know, time in the gym on the treadmill, just watching the calorie tick over and over and up and up. Yeah. And you'd get to a certain number and be like, okay, yeah, done. And that to me was exercise. And my relationship with fitness, with movement, was pretty one-dimensional. It was all about body composition. And I guess as well, coming from a dance background, that being a big part of my childhood, that was something that was always at the forefront of my mind anyway. So again, like I said, I wasn't into like fitness as such, but I did love to dance. And wrapped up within that was this idea that you had to remain small, that there was one certain body type that was kind of, you know, preferred. And so I guess as I had that, you know, journey through sport and exercise, it was all very much prefaced by, well, I'm going to just do it to make myself smaller then.
Right, which still very much was the case when you started your career as well. Like there are, you know, there have absolutely been different body trends, horrifically. But I also, you know, it was still very much like be as small as possible.
Yeah.
It was very much in the kind of just post the era of like all of the kind of tabloids, the things, you know, you like the fact that you would literally have a magazine where with like a celebrity on the front being like, looks like she's put on 10 pounds, horror stories of like no one wants to live with her. Such an insane era, which we obviously haven't truly grown out of, but that obviously, you know, was still really the landscape when you started posting about fitness.
Yeah. And I also think that even if we take a step back from that, my understanding and my relationship with food, exercise, all these things didn't necessarily even start from there. It started like in the home, you know, when I think about my mum's relationship with food. And I do think that when we think about all of these, you know, experiences and all of our kind of strange relationships that we have with food and exercise as women, you know, I feel like we're in a much better place now, but there's still a lot of, like you said, that stuff floating around. We have to look back to our mothers and their mothers and their experiences and the fact that this stuff isn't new. It's just often, you know, chameleoning into other formulas. But actually, you know, I remember being as young as 7, 8 and, you know, going with my mum to her personal trainer where, you know, it was all about kind of, you know, oh, I've got to lose weight. And there was this big thing about exercise being totally connected to weight loss and then not really being much else to it. And so, you know, no wonder that's what I believed. And, you know, when I started my own journey of training or whatever, that I genuinely solely believed that exercise was there to change how we looked. And that it was rooted in fat loss. So yeah, of course, that was, you know, what I set out to do when I started my journey, you know, online. At the time, there was just absolutely nothing wrong with the fact that I was in an already fairly small, lean body, but yet that wasn't enough and I wanted to be smaller and I was praised for that journey.
Right. And before we come on to speak more about that in the beginning of your kind of career in fitness, I want to talk a little bit about your career on the West End, purely from a point of selfish interest.
Yeah.
What did your days look like?
Well, so I was in a UK number one tour. So I graduated from Bird College. And I actually graduated early because I got my first job in Annie, which was really exciting. And before anyone asked, no, I didn't play Annie. Everyone was like, were you Annie? No. Guys, I was in the like adult ensemble, and I actually covered Grace Farrell, which is like the lead female part. So that was fun. And, you know, it was amazing to get a job in an industry that I had dreamt my whole life of being in. Like when I was a little girl, like I would be going to, you know, musicals in the West End and just sitting there and being like, why can't it be me?
Oh my God, it's such,
you know,
like, I still go there and I'm like,
yeah. And I think that like, and one of the things that I'm at peace with now, which is why it's really nice that I can look back on those times with such fond memories, is I did it. And I'm really proud of myself for doing that. Like I did a year tour, and in answer to your question, like it was hard work, like the hardest I've ever worked in my life. At the time I had started the, you know, Instagram page. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of doing stuff for that. I was also training a lot because, you know, as we said, exercise became a big part of changing my body composition. And then at the same time, doing 8 to 10 shows a week, moving around to different cities in the UK every week. So I remember starting up in Newcastle. And when you're on a tour, I think I was on roughly like £400 a week, just being totally honest, so, which, you know, was difficult in the sense that a lot of that then had to go on my accommodation. I was moving around every week.
Oh, they don't pay for your accommodation in the tour?
Oh, no, no. No. Yeah. This is like...
Scandal.
Yeah. The crazy world of like theatre touring.
Obviously, with no job, you would expect them to pay for that. Apart from if they're making you... Like, if you're relocated for secondment or something...
Yeah.
You were given a moving fee, but also you would have had to pay for short-term accommodation. You would have had to pay for a hotel.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I mean, we got per diems, which was kind of like a bit of money towards our travel, yeah, especially because we were traveling so much between each city.
You had to pay for the travel?
Well, yeah, pretty much. Like a lot of people
on the draw.
Yeah. Oh, babe, it was like, yeah, spit and sawdust, real hard work. And I have to tell you the story, right? And this is where, like, I think it really gave me a good grounding of like genuine hard work.
Right.
That's not to say that I don't think other people don't work really hard, but it was for me that probably that experience that I needed that really took me back to basics and taught me such a high level of discipline. So my first stop on our UK tour was in Newcastle. And I was a complete newbie to touring, never done it before. So I had no idea in terms of like the, you know, if I did it again, I'd be much more well-versed, but I rocked up in Newcastle and I'd messaged this guy that was in the year below me at school who I knew was at uni there. And I was like, hey, like, have you got a spare room? Like, can I stay in your spare room? And I just can't even believe I even did that. But I rocked up to he was like, yeah, sure. I'm not actually there because it wasn't in uni time, but you're welcome to stay in my room. I was like, great, amazing, free room. So save myself a bit of money. So I got to this house in Newcastle and I go in, this like, stoner lets me in. He's like, hey, the room's upstairs. And got to this room and there were no bed sheets. There was no working light. So I got back to the house after finishing rehearsals at like 11 p.m., walked through the door, like the light in my bedroom didn't work and the tap didn't turn off. So it was just like dripping the whole night. And I honestly lay there like this and just was like, I can't do this. I remember ringing my mom and crying and being like, I can't do this, mom. I can't do this. And she was like, yeah, you can. You're going to take yourself back to the theater tomorrow and you're gonna find yourself. Like, my mom's always been really good at never like giving me a leg up. Like, she's always been like, find a solution, Alice.
Yeah,
do it. So went back to the theater, ended up finding another room in some old man. I mean, now I think about it, I'm not kidding you when I say I stayed in, this man must have been like 65, something like that, chain smoker, had a spare room, single bed in a high rise in Newcastle. Absolutely lovely man, by the way, but had no idea who he was, just complete stranger. And there I am, having had failed digs on my first night, rocked up to his house and I was like, hey, I'm going to be staying with you for 2 weeks. Like, here's my bags. I've got to run to the theater, but see you later. Left all my stuff there, my worldly possessions, and was like, hi.
That's so wild.
And honestly, and then the funniest part was, like I said to you at the time, I was like doing all the stuff on my Instagram as well. So every morning he'd like come in and I was like arranging my bowl on the kitchen table with like my perfect like porridge or whatever, yeah, I made. She was like, what is this girl doing
around the outside?
Not even kidding you, I used to travel with plates in my suitcase. Like, I gave up space in my suitcase so that I could travel with like plates and cooking stuff so that I could carry on posting on my Instagram. Like, that was the level of commitment to the cause. But yeah, it was a crazy ride. I don't talk about it that much, but there were some wild experiences in terms of like, I remember one room that I stayed in Portsmouth in this like lovely old lady's house who clearly had like some kind of cognitive decline. I'd walk in and then like the kettle would just be like boiling and there'd be something on the hob. And I had this tiny single bed in her house where I couldn't even get my suitcase in the room. So like my suitcase had to be like outside the room. And like, it was really wild. And I think that, you know, going back to what I said about teaching me hard work, but also like giving me such a good grounding of like life outside of London and in different people's homes. I stayed in so many different places. I met so many amazing people. And for all the like bad days, there were some amazing ones. Like, I remember staying with this family in Oxford and being like, can I move in with you guys? Like, I love you.
Really like to be part of your family.
Yeah. So yeah, touring was really hard. To anyone who does it, it's like hats off to you. And I think that just generally, and I know that you come from kind of a theatre and music background as well, like, it is difficult. And I think that I have so much respect for all performers, but particularly those in musicals, because I think it is really, really tough to live in a world where you are getting like constant rejection. The money's not even great. So once you do even get a job, it's like, well, I'm still struggling. there's not great rights in terms of like what you're able to do within a contract. And, you know, I've got friends that are in shows and have had all sorts of difficult things go on. So I did a year and then I was like, I'm going to just take a bit of time out from touring. I was like mentally and physically exhausted. I wrote my first book while I was on tour as well. So I was doing 8 to 10 shows a week.
Within that first
within
year.
Within that first year, I was also writing my book. So I'd like finish the show at like 10:30, I think. Or no, 10 we came down because we had kids in the show. So 10 we'd come down. I'd go home and maybe work for 2 hours. I'd then be up at 6 a.m. I'd sleep for like 4 hours, be up the next morning, go to the gym, film a workout at the gym because I had to post that on my Instagram, get to the theater. We always had rehearsals because we had loads of kids in the show, so we were constantly rehearsing in new kids. So it was just, it was a lot. And I'll tell you my kind of like rock bottom moment. But basically, I don't know if anyone knows Annie the Musical, but I had the part of Star to Be, which is the girl that comes out with the suitcases and it's like NYC. I won't sing it. That was me.
You could sing it all.
Yeah, I'd
like it.
That was me. And I remember that I was in Aylesbury at the theatre in Aylesbury, and this was towards the end of the tour. And this was at a point when I, you know, when people say they're like mentally, physically like drained, I had nothing left in the tank. Bear in mind as well, I was also suffering from disordered eating. So my brain was not functioning, and we can go into that. But I was at the theatre in Aylesbury. I had my mum in the audience because that's like close to my hometown where I grew up. And I stepped out onto the stage to sing this solo part where the stage is empty. It's just me. And it's just me and these 2 suitcases. And I have maybe like a minute of singing on my own on the stage. What do? I come out. I've done this show maybe 100 times before, maybe more. My mind is blank. Nothing. Nothing comes out.
That is my worst.
So I literally stood there and I'm like, I sing the first line. And then I literally just look out at this audience. And I'm like, I have not got a fucking clue what's supposed to come out of my mouth next. What do I do? I'm like... And then I was like, I sang crap. Like I can't even tell you what I sang. I can't tell you what words came out. But I remember my mum coming to the stage door at the end of the show. And she was like, what happened tonight? She's seen the show before. She was like, what happened tonight? She's like, she had a minor blip. But yeah, oh
that
God.
That is my worst. That
I can't even, I'm actually getting hot thinking about it. Because
I'm getting hot. I'm like
sweating. It was really stressful. But yeah, that's probably one of my favorite stories from tour was just having a complete and utter mind blank. And I know there's lots of people in theater who've had the same. It's like a weird thing in your brain where you've done something so many times before.
Right.
And then suddenly you're like,
because also you're not thinking
gone.
About it because it's yeah. like the, yeah. Oh, God, that makes me so... deeply uncomfortable. That is food for my next few nightmares. So thank you so much for that. You've alluded to it within that uh-huh. story. Obviously, this was kind of simultaneous. Like you were simultaneously blowing up on social media, mm-hmm. and at a time where blowing up on social media meant a lot. I don't say that to diminish people blowing up on social media now. Like I'm not fucking blowing up on social media now, but it's more like it's very different. Like in terms of the virality was reserved for. People kind of really, 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 really blowing up in a kind of personal brand sense who would also get book deals, who would also get like all of these different things. Like it was a huge thing. Mm. Can you tell me the story of how you grew your page, how it kind of started? Like what was happening then?
First of all, there were just less of us. So the opportunity to go viral was, you know, higher. But you're right that it was a very different type of kind of viral. Social media was really new. And it was in its infancy in the sense that like everyone was just kind of muddling about and doing their best. But there was so much messiness to it that I actually really missed. Like I missed the kind of messiness and the authenticity of social media back then. And that's not to say that people can't be authentic now. It's just very different in terms of its like style. But I started posting when I was at college. So this was before I went on the tour. Really, I set out to create a food diary. I had this ambition that, you know, everyone thinks about like a moment in their life that really changed them. And I know that it wasn't one necessarily big catalyst, but there was definitely a meeting that I had with a teacher at my college. And she sort of sat me down at the end of my, I think it was at the end of my first year. And she said something like, you know, and bear in mind, I'd gone to this college and I was definitely like lower down in terms of my capabilities. Like I remember feeling such imposter syndrome and I actually fell flat on my face, actually flat on my ass in my first year jazz assessment and literally like one of the grounds swallowed me up. Like I wasn't great. I remember her sitting me down. I didn't get great marks in my first year assessments. And she said to me, you know, Alice, like, you just really need to get stronger. Like, you're lacking strength. You don't have enough core strength to support you. And it's really apparent, like, in the way that you dance. That was what she said. And, like, it wasn't said in a really harsh way. But, you know, when something really sticks in your brain. And so when I moved into, like, my second year and kind of through my college experience, I was like, you know, I kind of took that as, well, I need to lose weight. Like, my body's not right. I need to change myself. And I think that I had such a deep hunger to succeed in the theater industry that it was almost as though, like, it was just a non-negotiable that had to happen. And I think that's really sad because, you know, theater is becoming so much more diverse, slowly, but it is. But at the time, it really wasn't. And so, you know, I remember girls in my year who, you know, all of us were pretty petite, very petite, and still thinking that we weren't quite enough for, you know, what the industry wanted. And we were told, and, you know, there was a lot of kind of toxic language used and stuff that I guess colored how we felt about ourselves. But yeah, it was that moment that made me feel as though I needed to change my body. And so I started this Instagram as a way of creating a food diary. And really, it was just taking pictures of pretty horrendous looking plates of food that were terribly cooked, very bland, but they were my way of keeping some level of accountability in terms of what I was eating. I never intended for myself to go viral. You and I both started at a time where being an influencer didn't even exist, right? We just were trying to build a community maybe, or like engage with like-minded people. I think for me, mine was, you know, I'm going to start this page. And initially it was private. When I made it public, it was solely so that I could engage with people who were doing similar things to myself. I just enjoyed that level of interaction. And I think when you're, you know, I was living at the time in a house full of three guys and one girl, and like none of them wanted to hear about my diet adventures. So I was like, well, I'll share it with people online instead. So yeah, I didn't set out in any way for it to grow to what it did, but it just so happened that it was at a time when there was a definite appetite for diets and health and fitness related content. You know, we have to reference people like Joe Wicks and Delicious Yella, who really were the kind of first in terms of Kayla Itzinez as well, another person who I remember as being the first in terms of this new wave of young wellness kind of inspirations, let's call it.
I think part of it, and I don't mean this as a criticism of everything, I think this was the case with mine as well, it was disguised as a health thing.
Oh yeah.
When in a lot of the, and don't get me wrong, part of it was, and I, you know, was very much in pursuit of some idea of like healthful thought that losing weight was going to make me healthier or like whatever it might be. But like the appetite was for things that were a rebellion against the kind of like heroin chic, but were kind of not that different. Like it felt different, and that's what people wanted. They wanted this like super clean, very kind of like healthy and colorful and all of this, rather than like cigarettes and coffee. Like there was that change, which felt healthier, and so therefore was like very much glorified in terms of like, you know, it was essentially what we should all aspire to because it was healthy. We definitely didn't understand things like orthorexia or anything like that at the time.
I think that's such an important point to make, and I completely agree with you, because I genuinely, hand on heart, when I first started doing everything that I was doing, I genuinely thought I was pursuing health. To me, I had no idea that actually what I was doing was unbelievably restrictive, incredibly disordered. Those things weren't even on my radar. I was like, I'm the pinnacle of health. I've cut out all these things that, you know, because when I first went to uni, like my first year at uni was spent like having total food freedom in the way that I'm really glad that I did. I'm so happy I had that year because it was amazing. But, you know, I was eating pizza for dinner every night. I was having ice cream with my friends. We would get Domino's every Sunday and I'd have like a pizza and a half. Like it was just like I had total food freedom. So with that being my before, let's say, to then go to what I was doing and the kind of way that I was eating and my approach to exercise, it felt completely normal, healthy. You know, I didn't have any concept of it being dangerous or damaging.
And I don't think any of us did.
No.
And I feel like that's one of the things that I've struggled with as the discourse has changed in terms of like, you only know that I've spoken to on this podcast with Steph Claire Smith, with Deliciously Ella, like there was, it didn't blow up just because of the person doing it. I can imagine because we've, you know, we now kind of demonize the term clean eating. That was very transparently in your the name of your business. Yeah. And like that's, it's so interesting because, you know, you want to be able to move past it and look at it and be like, yeah, do you know what? Like, I mean, you've said openly, like I had, it was very disordered in my eating, all of it was restrictive, like all of these different things. You didn't know that at the time. And actually you were doing very much what you thought to be the right thing. And actually the reason you had such a following was because other people aspired to be like that. And it's so interesting, I think, in a kind of wider societal sense when we look at like the different trends on social media and how things have changed. And we're so quick to demonize past trends whilst also not having any acknowledgement of like the current or the fact that everyone within those trends was being lifted up because they were doing what everyone else wanted to see. Does that make sense? I feel like I've explained that quite badly.
No, you haven't at all. You've explained it really well. And I completely agree with you. And I think that I hold and continue to hold an immense amount of guilt for the narrative that I played out, you know, online. And that's quite difficult, you know, because I will still have people who are convinced that I'm a fraud. You know, I've only changed my opinion because it's got me traction, or, you know, because the discourse changed and therefore I had to. And I am still, you know, messaged by people who are like, well, do you still believe what you wrote in your first book? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I had to play out really publicly in terms of a big climb down and a big acknowledgement of getting it wrong. And I think that I've tried to do that with grace. And, you know, I've tried to do it in a way that allows me to be vulnerable and share the mistakes that I've made. But I do think that there's a part of me that feels, you know, that there does need to be a conversation had about how it was a wider context of a movement rather than it being individual people really driving that narrative.
Yeah. And also, I think that, like, it's really interesting because I think that it's so, I think it's right that you've like had a conversation about it. And I think it's right that you've said, do you know what, this is what I was part of. This is what I believe now, kind of that type of conversation. What I think is even more important is the fact that we acknowledge that we are part of a culture that makes those things happen. Like I, that was also your journey. As much as it, you know, you say you hold a huge amount of guilt, I'm really sorry that like that must be really tough. I also think, and you know, like I can completely see, like it's such a change industry, but I also think that that was also your journey. A lot of people go from teenagerhood, whatever it is, to kind of being an adult and have these big changes and change in like what was healthy, what was not healthy. The fact that we make teenagers or very young adults so famous and put them in such a position of authority creates an environment that it makes that happen. And also, like, you were also the one who had to have that disordered eating.
Yeah,
I don't say had to because you had to, I mean that you went through that, as in you know, as much as you posting salads might have affected someone else, it also affected you, and that was a very real journey you had as well. And you couldn't have realized that any other way than going through it, much like we all will have had our own private journeys with unhealthy relationships, with food, with any of those things. At the time, we thought it was the right thing. And therefore, if you're in a position of authority, you're going to be saying that's the right thing.
Yeah.
That's nothing you know until
yeah,
I know it later. Like I used to say all, like on YouTube, used to like have such strong opinions about things that I look back now and I'm like, you know nothing.
And I also think like, isn't that life? Don't we have to get things wrong in order to get them right? Like, who leaves school and suddenly makes every decision, you know, in the right way and never makes a mistake? Like, I think, and, you know, to a certain extent, I've been grateful for the continued support in that transition. But when I think back and I think about my experiences, you know, for example, like I was 22 when I signed my first book deal. Like, that is so young. When I now think about 22-year-old me and I think about the amount of, you know, I got a six-figure paycheck for that first book. Like, what? you know, like, who does that?
It says so much about us.
Yeah. And I had zero, like, I think I just got my personal training qualification. I had zero nutritional qualifications. And as much as I was driving that ambition to, you know, I'm having these opportunities given to me, of course I'm going to take them. Like, again, like I said, when the background was that year of hard work on tour, someone, a book agent turns around to you, says, I'm going to give you X amount of money to write a book. Who is going to turn around and say, actually, no? Like, I didn't have the confidence that I have now in the importance of qualifications and know-how and all that sort of stuff. Like, I didn't have that. I think to myself, like, I didn't really have anyone protecting me.
I didn't.
And when an article came up in the Daily Mail that said Alice is the, you know, cause of eating disorders, and I remember having a complete physical breakdown, as in, like, I lost it. And I was like, how has this happened? You know, I just think to myself, like, I think there could have been, I don't want to, it's not that I'm pointing any blame at all, because I actually think that we were all just part of a really toxic time.
Yeah.
And I think that now I'm just grateful that I have really, and I know this sounds a bit cliche to say, but, like, done the work and had to unlearn a lot of stuff. And, like, you know, I do have guilt, because I'd be crazy not to, because I know that what I did had an impact on a lot of people. So for me to just say, oh, you know, I was just a product of my environment, I don't necessarily feel that. I do feel that there has to be some level of accountability, right? But at the same time, I also think I'm grateful for the journey that it's given me, because I find myself now sat here and I'm like, I'm in a good place, you know? I have good people around me. I have amazing management. I've got a business that's thriving. I have a fiance. Like, I have a life that I'm happy for. And I, again, going back to my original point, like, I've made mistakes in order to get to this point. And don't we all? Like, don't we all fumble our way through?
I completely agree with all of that. And I think it's really powerful. And I'm so grateful to you for talking about it, because I feel like that's actually how we reclaim the conversation as well, when it's kind of that must have been really hard for a number of reasons. I do think that when we talk about something like some things like this, when it comes to social media, we talk about them as if the person has committed a literal crime.
Yeah.
Like, as in, like, you saying, like, I, you know, what I did, like, all of this, it literally sounds like you murdered someone. And, like, I think there is a disproportionate nature of social media when we have this very black and white approach to something that, like, you know, for example, that article saying, you know, you caused eating disorders. You also had your own eating disorder, and we lived in a society where they would offer someone who perhaps has that. And perhaps if anyone had looked at that and said, that's a 22-year-old, I would actually say, from a position of, like, if they got a nutritional expert in, and that nutritional expert was like, or psychologist or whatever, was like, oh, by the way, the thing I would be careful about is this. No one's looking out for that.
Mm.
Everyone's looking out for, like, how they can make the money. Most sales possible.
Yeah, I know.
And, like, it is not, like, I think there are a lot of questions to be asked when we are in a society that creates an environment that a 22-year-old with, in that scenario, is, I think, you're offered six figures to write a book.
Yeah. And honestly, like, that's why I'm so great. Like, I moved management. After I signed that book deal, I was with someone else, and I moved to the management I'm with now, who I've been with for, like, my entire career. And, like, the level of safeguarding now and protection that I have experienced, like, this is more speaking to a point to, you know, anyone who's an influencer or an up and coming content creator, like, having someone who is genuinely looking out for you makes all the difference to your career. Like, I have felt so supported legally, financially, emotionally, you know, from a kind of pastoral perspective, like, just completely supported by my agency and by my manager in particular, when my previous experience was probably not so great, you know, that made all the difference. And I genuinely, when I were to say what's given me the ability to carry on and to have longevity, it's genuinely that's a big part of the puzzle for me. Yes, it was me being able to do the work and being able to really, like, go on that journey of, you know, as we've spoken about. But I also think that that is a really important point to make. I don't do this alone. Like, I'm grateful that someone, you know, Izzy, my manager, found me, supported me, took me in a completely different direction that has continued to help me to thrive and has given me all of the protection that I need compared to that initial situation.
And that's also such a sign of a good person as well, for many reasons, because I can imagine that when you went through a huge transition in terms of your content, in terms of what you're promoting, in terms of not being a golden girl, in terms of, like, you're talking about that press, like, any of these different things in an industry that encourages exploitation, I mean that in a soft sense, you essentially at that age, that's what was happening. It could have been very easy to see the cash dollar going in another direction and actually understanding. And I do think that's one of the biggest issues with this industry, is that the function of it and the function of the cycles and how fast those cycles move means that it is very tempting to, you know, if a 19-year-old blows up tomorrow for whatever reason, no one is going to stop to think for a second about how they can get the most out of that. And equally, as soon as that person gets some negative press or falls down or is less exciting, no one's going to stop for a second at dropping that and moving on to the next one. It is by its nature pretty toxic, as you know, when you don't have the right people.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
At what point did you realize that your content needed to change?
Well, first of all, I think that I just started changing how I was approaching health and fitness. It wasn't that I led it from a content perspective.
Right.
It was more that I recognized in myself that there was a lot of behaviors that were pretty disordered.
Mm.
And I had to work to go through those behaviors and understand why they were problematic and overcome them. And that makes it sound really easy. It wasn't. There was a woman that I came across who I reference as, like, changing my life. She's amazing. And she was a client. I was a personal trainer at a gym in Southwest London. And she was a client there, not of mine, actually, of a friend of mine. She is an acupuncturist. And she said, like, come and see me for a session. I'd love to see you, because I was having some issues with my periods, i.e. I wasn't having one. You know, like, I think up until that point, I'd known that there was something, like, not right. And I'd known that what I was doing was pretty unhealthy by that point. Like, I'd started to understand the levels of, like, disordered eating that I was going through and the impact that was having on my body and, you know, and more. But I remember going to see Emma, and, like, she sat me down and she was asking me all these questions. And then she starts asking me, like, quite weird ones. And when, like, anyone that has met or knows Emma Cannon, like, she's a bit of, like, a witch. Like, she's kind of a bit, like, crazy in the best way possible. Just started asking all these weird questions. And then she was like, darling, she was like, can I be really honest with you? And I was like, yeah, of course. And she was like, you are too thin, your body is struggling, you're doing too much exercise, and I think that you need to eat more, and we're going to help you get there in order to get your period back, but you've got to trust me. And I was like, oh my God, like, she literally, you know, when, like, your mum kind of sits you down and she's like, what you're doing is not quite right, and we just need to put a bit of work in to get you better. And I think that it was like that she did it in such a, like, maternal, caring way. Like, it didn't feel like the overwhelming noise that was coming from, like, disordered eating is bad, what you're doing is bad. It felt like someone actually was, like, genuinely caring for me, and like, that I was going through the same thing that lots of other people were. And she just, oh my God, helped me change my life, like, big time. Even just learning that, like, my body was just experiencing too much stress. Like, I was just doing way too much. Mm-hmm. And understanding that, like, no doctor had told me that. You know, I'd gone to the doctor however many times and had all sorts of conversations about PCOS and all these things that might be going on, and actually really my body was just struggling to function.
Yeah, and that's so classic as well, because what I feel like there's so much within our healthcare system, which worth saying is fantastic and very important and just needs to be invested in more, but, like, the fact that no one will see, there's, especially when it comes to women, like, there's such a binary approach to, like, seeing someone being like, well, they're not a skeleton.
Mm.
And also seeing someone and being like, well, like, as in, like, either side. It's like, well,
yeah, Yeah, I know.
I'll just offer you one of these five things that you might have that we can now treat.
I think we're getting better. Like, I think even the conversations around like amenorrhea and in particular hypothalamic amenorrhea, and like, for those that aren't sure, that the loss of a period basically through too much stress on the body, low energy availability, too much exercise, stress, you know, whatever. We are talking more about it. Doctors do know more about it, but you know, it's hard because a lot of the time, and this is such a big thing in my journey, is like, and actually it's a bigger thing, like if we take a step back, not even maybe necessarily with like, you know, body composition, but just generally, like, you have to be ready to come to the decision to say goodbye to some of that stuff before, you know, before you allow those opinions in. So I reckon that Emma could have met me a year earlier and said those things to me, and I'd have been like, she doesn't know what she's talking about.
Yeah.
But I think I was so ready and I so wanted to change that I took on board what she said so wholeheartedly and was like, oh my God, like this is obviously going to, you know, this is what I need to do. And I think I had to say goodbye to my quote unquote dream body, what I thought was my dream body. That was something that I had to acknowledge, that I was like, I'm going to have to lose it. It has to go because I can't keep that and be healthy. And that's like a grieving process because I'd worked to get to this point where I had this body that I thought was like, you know, I would take pictures of myself every day and I would, you know, had this rippling six pack. I was on the front cover of Women's Health magazine. Like, I was told by people all the time, oh, you look amazing. And I knew that that had to go. I was like, I can't keep this. This is not healthy for me. This is not what I need to be prioritizing. So it was that. And I think that, you know, anyone that's going through the same thing, like, it is a grieving process because, you know, like it or not, like, we are so linked to how we feel about our bodies, and that's so connected to confidence and mood, and you know, everything that we do is so connected. So I just think that, like, it was almost that realization. It was like, I'm going to have to say goodbye to this body and I'm going to have to go on this journey where I start to accept that it's going to change. Always at the forefront of that was, I need to do it because the life that I was living had become so small. Like, I had no social life. Every occasion I would always manage to get out of, anything that was revolved around food, I would have an excuse for. I was like the queen of, you know, getting out of stuff, and just like, it's almost like the walls just started to close in on me. I was unbelievably lonely. Like, I cannot tell you. I was like chronically lonely. I moved into a flat on my own because I thought that's what I wanted. But I would spend so many nights just like, just despondent and lonely and just like not living my life, but too afraid to go out and live it because I couldn't imagine going out and having food freedom or having the ability to like enjoy myself. So, you know, like, it just, it was a, like that, yeah, there was a rock bottom moment. And I recognized that the alternative was just so much richer in terms of what it could offer me. And that in order to move forwards to heal, that I had to, yeah, had to say goodbye to what I had and opt for change. And I'm not going to lie, like, it was difficult, but like now I'm like, God, thank God I did that. And I feel in such a better place for it, of course. But yeah, I do think that that's a difficult journey that people do have to go on. And anyone that does it, you know, full respect, because it is hard.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I do think there are horrifically statistics about how much eating disorders are even increasing. And I think that, you know, at the time that we were, I mean, I had so many friends
Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
But do you not think that it's like, I go on TikTok now, Grace, and I'm terrified by what I see.
It's turned into 2000s.
Yeah.
2010s.
And I almost...
Social media.
Yeah. I look at it and I'm like, guys, you're doing what I did. Like, I almost just want to like shout and scream and be like, stop. Like, this is not the solution. But it's almost like at every generation, they have to make the same mistakes. And I don't know how we undo that.
I do think an element of it is the fact that we now have social media, and therefore the reason you were in a position that set an example to anyone else in the way you were eating was because you yourself were going through that journey, just like I did, just like all of my sisters did to some extent, just like all of my friends did, all to different extents, all different people, you know, some had, you know, real eating disorders and some just, you know, had a little bit of a yo-yo diet here and there. The fact that
those people have newspaper type reach is exactly the recipe for that.
Mm.
Like the fact that, you know, I've seen it, I find it really interesting how much criticism, for example, I've seen some fitness influencers get when they've come out essentially saying, yeah, do you know what? I had an eating disorder between this year and this year. And people are like, well, I was following you and you were telling me that was good. And it's like, yeah, yeah, no, I literally thought that was good.
Mm.
And I was also, you know, 20 or 30 and thought that was the right thing. Like that's the whole, social media is a perpetuation of what we individually are going through or want to portray. Therefore, it's always like there is an element of it that's going to be quite cyclical.
Yeah.
Like, is it going to happen to every single 18-year-old? Like, with social media now, like, it's probably far more pervasive. And I'm not sure how we do stop that.
Yeah. You're so smart, Grace. Wow.
I don't know. It's very profound.
I'm, like, sat here and I'm like, yeah. Go, girl. Yeah. It. You know, you're right. You're so right. And I am fearful for what's to come. But I'm also hopeful that at least we have, like, to a certain extent, amazing role models in the public eye in general. Like, I remember my upbringing, and I now reference the current kind of media talent that we have that, you know, that is kind of ever present. And I think there is more diversity. We're not fully there, but there's definitely more. And I am glad that there are, you know, celebrities who come in different body shapes, and that there is more diversity across the board, you know, in every category. There's more of that. Does it go far enough? No. Does it help the entire problem? No. But does it mean that some people might feel less alone? You know, yes. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, social media isn't going away. It's growing at an exponential rate. And that means that there are going to be pockets of the internet that continue to perpetuate these toxic narratives, and there's nothing that you or I sitting here can do to stop it, except for the fact that we can only control what we can control, right? We can only control our own messaging, our own narrative, and what we do within that space. And, you know, I made it my mission to never go back to where I was, and to always have a really clear ethos and a really clear approach moving forwards, having done my own healing. But you know, like, I can't change the world. I wish I could.
Yeah. And that also doesn't mean that you won't have, this is depressing. It doesn't also mean that you won't have something else that you know, and that I won't have something that I'll live my life in a certain way for some time. And I'll be like, this is how you should be doing it. And this is, you know, I try, like, I feel like one of a good rule is once you've learned never to tell people what they should be doing, you learn that pretty harshly, yeah, in terms of, you know, when you go back on something like you have, like, mm-hmm, I have. I do think that, like, there's an element of that. Like, I have no doubt that, like, when I don't know, might be when I have children, like, showing that on social media and being like, oh, well, these are the three things that I think, and then I'll look at that after my 17th child and think, fucking hell, that's a terrible idea, or whatever it might be. Like, it is, the human experience will always be multiplied out to everyone else based on, yeah, the fact that we have social media.
The one thing that I would say is, like, and I'd love to hear what you feel about this, but, like, I now just and terrified of being online. Like, I'm at a point in my career where I'm not really I'm not really growing. I'm not really kind of like I have my focuses that I feel like I'm doing good in, but genuinely every time I go to, like, open my phone or to say something, I am so fearful in a way that I've never been before. Like, I almost feel like people are just waiting for there to be a mistake or waiting for you to say the wrong thing. And I'm concerned for, like, what that does for people like you and I in terms of, like, you know, I don't know what the point I'm trying to make, but I guess, like, you know, at the start of this conversation, I said I loved the messiness of social media in 2015 or whenever it was that I started, you know, like, the messiness and the mistakes and the kind of the like, friendliness as well, are all wrapped up in that, like, that people were just nice.
Yeah.
And naturally, as it's grown, of course there's going to be so much discourse and so many people thinking and feeling different things, and there being disagreements and, you know, many mistakes made by both you and I. I'm sure we've both had our fair share of them, but I just find it so much more difficult to deal with. Like, I do not know how you do it. I don't know how other people do it. And how they have such a deep level of resilience. Like, I'm such a people pleaser.
I was about to say, it's because you're a people pleaser. That's literally my answer is going to be, it's because you're a people pleaser.
Me.
And no, but what I actually think is that's exactly why I stopped social media being my main job. Because I am a people pleaser and I like to be liked and I like to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And the very nature of social media means you cannot context collapse for every single person. Like, I will put one version of something out and I expect it to be received well by every single person. Like, that is nuts. Like, when you think about that logically, that doesn't make any sense. When I tell a story to three of my friends, I'll tell it differently. So why, what about if I tell it to 500,000 people, half of whom like me, half of whom hate me, half of whom have like no idea who I am, like whatever.
Yeah.
And so like, its nature is not compatible with people pleasing. And that is why I got to a point where I was like, this is not the career for me. Mm-hmm. And like, I understand that is a hugely privileged position to be in to make that decision. I made that decision and had a few really tough years and literally sliced my income by an obscene amount. But I also, I'm really happy now. Mm-hmm. And like, I also, and it's different, you know, it's different problems and like, you know, whatever. Sometimes I think I'm like, I could be a fucking influencer on a beach right now. Like, what are you doing? Like, why did you make that decision? Like, lots of people want to be in that position. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I'm obviously still doing it to some extent. But the important thing for me was getting to a point where I could say, do you know what? If you don't want me here, I cannot be here for the next year and yeah. I'll still be fine.
Yeah.
And even just having that option, it's like a fuck off fund for like mental capacity. But like, I think that, I don't know, I also think that there was an element of that by having that, it enabled me to worry less. Because I also think that there is this issue with social media in that because we see it so black and white, we have such disproportionate reactions to things. Like, sometimes I see the reasons why some people were cancelled, and like, don't get me wrong, like, some of them are, you know, correct and like, you know, very valid, and like, but other ones when it's like, you're not actually angry about that, like, you cannot actually tell me that you're angry about that. You saw that and you thought, god, that's out of touch, and then you scrolled past. You're not actually angry, like, you haven't thought about that at all today. You just know that that isn't PR friendly. And there is this disproportionate reaction that we're starting to foster based on the fact that that disproportionate reaction itself also gets traction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's always going to be the reality of social media. And I think the thing that made me more comfortable with it was being able to be like, okay, well, I'm deciding to be here rather than needing to be here. And that's probably just a mental thing as well, because no one needs to be anywhere. But actually, I mean, for me, I needed to spend 2 years basically being like, I'm going to put myself in a position where, you know, that can be the case. But also that's allowed me to then spend less time caring and instead be able to, because I also just went through a period of time where I was like so vanilla and so like flavorless on social media, and then I looked at all of the people that I love to follow and all of them have like strong opinions and they say it how they mean and they clap back as well. Like, sometimes people get angry at them, and don't get me wrong, there's a time and a place for being like, do you know what, I absolutely didn't mean it like that. There's also a time and a place for being like, you know, I didn't mean it like that. Stop trying to catch me out, go touch some grass. Like, and like, get over it. And I think that every single person who I love to follow felt it was kind of like that. And I also thought that I had like taken away every single part of my personality to be palatable to so many people that wouldn't even like me in real life. And it's like, is that my life's work? Like, is that the reason I was put on this planet?
Oh god, yeah, like, so many amazing points, Grace. You're a wise girl. I love it. I feel like this is a therapy session for me, for sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
But I feel like also at the same time, this is where like the disproportionate reaction comes in on social media. If any of the people who genuinely felt that strongly about, I don't know, it can be true at the same time that you affected someone's past, and also that you not just didn't mean to, because again, that sounds like you've committed a crime and done something terrible. And like, anyone who would meet you would know that you would never mean to hurt a fly.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of social media. Because we're able to create such movement, we're also able to create harm at a level that is disproportionate. That you couldn't have created harm at that level. the reason you were able to, it was able to be a movement was because of this like traction and because of the nature of like social media itself. And I do think that's really interesting that some of the nicest people I've ever met in real life have had that to some extent.
Yeah.
Like in terms of if they've been big on social media.
Well, nice, Grace.
Feel really nice. But I think it's so interesting that like we can create harm out of social media out of people who have never created harm in their
day-to-day. Do you know what's so funny though? And I was literally having this conversation with my hairdresser the other day. Lol. Classic like therapy chat in the hairdressers. But she was asking me about like, she was like, oh, do you ever get trolls and things like that? And I was like, yeah, I do. And I said, do you know what's so hard is that in a week I'll get so many nice messages from people. I guarantee you that it's on, you know, a Friday evening and I'll get a nasty message from someone. And my sole mission is to go back and prove to that person that I'm a nice person. And it will consume all of my energy. And in a way that I'm just so not backboned enough to be able to deal with criticism. And I'm working on it, guys. I am working on it. But I feel this like deep sense of like, I've always been a girl who's tried to do things right and tried to be the nice person and do the right thing. And social media, unfortunately, allows for people to make an opinion on you regardless of who you actually are. Like, I might be those things, sure, I might also not. But, you know, Susan in Sheffield doesn't care because she's already going to make an opinion of me and I'm never going to change that. But I have spent so many years online doing my best to prove to people that I'm likable, that I'm nice, that I'm good, that I'm palatable, you know, and I will bend over backwards to try and do that. And I'm at a point now where I am starting to recognize that, you know, and I said this to my hairdresser, so I was like, I'm just wasting so much time doing that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm wasting so much time.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say as well is like, that is not your purpose in life.
No.
It is not your purpose to convince Susan that you're a nice person. You know you're a nice person. All of the people around you know you're a nice person. And also, your purpose isn't even to be a nice person. Like, kind, yeah. Like, fuck nice. Like, we expect so much from, like, women in these types of positions too, because I can promise you that anyone else who existed at the same time, who was a man, would not have got the same response as well. So it's like, you have to be nice and you have to be palatable and you have to be digestible and like all of these different things. But like, Alice, that is not why you were put on this earth.
Yeah.
Like, you can be nice to all of the people around you on the everyday. It is not your duty to show up on social media and be nice to everyone.
I also think like, guys, I'm a personal trainer. Like, let's be real just for a second. Like, I'm literally a personal trainer. Like, I'm not really that much more than that. So like, when we talk about kind of like niceness and stuff, like, do you go up to every trader in your like local Virgin Active and say, are you a nice person? Like,
right.
Do you know what I mean? But like, I sort of sometimes have this moment where I do have a bit of confidence and I'm like, I am literally a fitness influencer. Like,
come on, guys. Stop it. That affects your life. But also, I do think that's it. Like, it's an element of, it's very much a sexist thing too. And no one can tell me it isn't, because it's also the fact that like, we, in order for you to be successful, people need to perceive you as nice. Otherwise, your success is not worthy. So, and that is what we have to for every single woman. I talked about that in a rant I did the other day on Instagram, where I was literally like, I was talking about a post I saw of Alex Cooper, and like all of the things were an attack on her person, which when you're talking, when someone's somewhere to talk about like the business they're doing or whatever, like, we don't demand of men for them to be nice in order for what they do to be impressive. Whereas we condition the fact that someone is successful on the fact that they're nice. And you can talk about all of the amazing things you've done and the amazing career you've had and like what you've built for yourself. And if you're not nice, it counts for nothing. First of all, you're fucking nice. Second of all, it doesn't matter whether anyone thinks you're nice.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong, it's important to be kind and it's important to be polite and all of these things. But like, if that's what social media is going to create, an environment where you essentially need to be such a dulled down version of yourself that you're so palatable to every single person, because you would have to be in order to be received well by everyone. And even then, some people are going to receive you as fucking vanilla and going to be annoyed about that too. It's just like, I think that's really sad. And I say it so passionately because I have been there and I have like stripped back every single part of my person. And then I've been like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Like, that cannot be why I'm on this earth. It also doesn't even matter. And I don't say that to belittle it. I say that because I think it's important to remember in a world where we've never dealt with this type of environment. You're obviously now, as you say, a personal trainer in London. What would you say if you were training yourself 10 years ago? What would you say to the you that you were training?
Ooh, that's such a good question. I think I would say less is more. It's probably one of my biggest learnings in fitness and in how I approach training clients, training myself. I think we place far too much emphasis on exercise than it actually is in terms of the, you know, health and well-being equation. And I think that we undervalue recovery and the importance of recovery. I think when we take a step back and we understand like the amount of global stress that our body experiences in any given day, in any given week, month, year, I think that we have to recognize that that balance needs to be in line. And if we're doing loads of exercise, but we're also not really sleeping very well, and we're also working a mega stressful job, and we've got, you know, relationship issues, and we are, you know, going through whatever else, environmental stress, whatever it may be, that's going to have an impact. And so I think that I would say to myself, you know, dial it back, basically. I now use this kind of within my coaching and my, you know, particularly on my app and with my clients, like this idea that we all have this internal dial that at any point in our lives, we can turn up and we can turn down. And learning that we are in control of that and that we can learn to dial things up if we need to, you know, if we're having a couple of months where we've been a bit slow on our training and we're maybe not doing so much, we've been quite sedentary, whatever, we can turn the dial up, but also really learning to turn it down. And I think for me, I would have gone back to that 22-year-old self, and I would have said, learn to turn the dial down, learn to take it back. Less is more. Food is really important. Eat well, sleep well, you know, do all the basics, but also don't overthink those things. You know, I think that we can become so obsessed with the minutiae of health and well-being. We can become so obsessed with like the ice baths and how many hours we should be sleeping and this app and that app and, you know, how much load should I be increasing my weights by every week and all these kind of things. And I think that like really for most people, it should actually be pretty basic. It shouldn't be occupying such a huge part of your headspace. It should be, you know, am I getting roughly 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night? Am I roughly training 3 to 4 times a week regularly? Am I eating a diet that's got variety and is, you know, got quite a lot of vegetables and enough protein? And yeah, like I just find myself getting a little bit frustrated by people that try and overcomplicate health and sell it to us as to this something that is so hard to reach and we're constantly striving for.
Right. Yeah, and it is so true as well that this is probably the first time in history that we've had that anyone that's not an athlete or something to that effect, like the quantity of people who train as if they are, act as if they are, eat as if they are. I don't mean that as a criticism, but I do think it's quite interesting that like for the first time ever, rather than us like going to our jobs, making our money, coming home, like having free time or whatever it might be, there is like this huge amount of training as if it's, you know, like you are an athlete in some way.
And I think that, you know, what we have to recognize is athletes have an immense amount of support around them. So like professional football team, women's football team, they will train every day, but they will nap every afternoon without fail, or they will have restful periods of non-sleep deep rest where they are able to turn their dial down, able to allow their bodies to recover, and they are monitored to the nth degree. They have their nutrition sorted down to the nth degree. They're ensuring that they're eating enough. They're not working another job. And, you know, I think we have to recognize that, look, this is one of the biggest things for me is like, what's most important to me? Like, for me, I just took a step back from everything that I was doing at age 21, where the priority was all about being thin and it was all about, you know, pushing my body and trying to get the most from myself in the pursuit of like, I don't know, greatness. And then I took a step back and I met my fiance and I developed a new friendship group. And I realized that like life is so much richer when those things are enjoyable things. Like I really love exercise, right? But because I love it, I've allowed myself to like it not to, it doesn't rule my life. You know, I don't stress if I miss a day. I love food. And that means that a lot of my meals, I prioritize foods that I know are going to make me feel good, but I'm also able to like go for dinner with friends or order a takeaway with Paddy if I want to. Or, you know, like I've just given it less of a big priority in my life. And maybe that's because I come from a background where it has been such a big occupation in my brain that for me, I am someone who needs to take a step back and give it less power. And, you know, we still live in an environment where I think it's 1 in 2 women in the UK don't do enough exercise each week, doing less than 30 minutes or something like that. So like there's still this imbalance of those that do loads and those that don't do enough. So, you know, my whole thing has been, I kind of want to be that trainer that falls in the middle and is like, exercise is really important. Like, don't get me wrong, but it's got to be something that you enjoy, that you're able to stick to long term, that doesn't feel like it's ruling you. And you know, that you can kind of just see it as like a happy addition to your life rather than something that is like a chore or a punishment, whatever.
Yeah, no, I think that's so, so, so important. And I think that is the perfect place to wrap up. Given we have gone off on, I feel like we've had such a good conversation.
Thank you so much as well.
No, thank you. I think this has been, yeah, it's been really incredible. And thank you so much for being so open and honest and transparent. I feel like we can't have these conversations unless we're actually having these conversations. And yeah, I'm really grateful to you for having that with me.
Thank you so much, Grace.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.